Some of those closest to Obama and some of his loudest media cheerleaders are advising him to look backwards towards FDR's New Deal for inspiration.
The idea of a new deal has crossed the lips of countless Democrats in the past 6 months. As Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern recently said, "I think we could be on the edge of an era in this country of bold, dramatic change equal to the Great Society and the New Deal." An aide close to Obama told New York Magazine that a lot of people around Barack are reading books about FDR's first 100 days. A kind of New Deal mania has gripped the pundit class.
It's the New Deal, and it's Barack Obama as FDR.
No, I want him to call for something like a New Deal.
But what if everything we think we know about the New Deal is wrong? What if FDR's massive intervention into the American economy actually prolonged the Great Depression?
When Obama was elected, many were quick to liken him to Abraham Lincoln. Both were eloquent intellectuals who became president during national turmoil without much political experience.
Many folks don't remember that President Lincoln also had a bad midterm election.
Absolutely.
How did he react to it compared to how President Obama?
Reminds me of another second inaugural Lincoln's. So much of Lincoln in that speech, from the Gettysburg Address to the second inaugural itself, I thought was interesting. It was an attempt to draw a balance. Of course, he's a man of the progressive side, but he tried to draw a balance there between a government ruled by an elite and then a government ruled by a mob, both being a problem. Then he talked about the government that we want, which is infrastructure, education, regulation, all the good things, and then recognized that government can't solve all the problems. I thought that was a reaching out, if you will, shouted a bit to the Tea Party right that's rejectionist.
Well, one constituency that has never deserted President Obama is Hollywood, and victory will have cheered perhaps his most high-profile supporter in Tinseltown, the director Steven Spielberg. Next week, he's releasing a film based on one of the most celebrated occupants of the White House, Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln stars the British actor Daniel Day-Lewis as the Civil War president leading the fight against slavery.
Abolishing slavery settles the fate for the millions now in bondage, and unborn millions to come.
It's based on the book Lincoln, Team of Rivals, a book read by Obama when he became president. It's said to have given him the idea of bringing into his cabinet his one-time foe, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State. The book's author, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, joins us now from New York. Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you very much for joining us. Now, we know that Obama very much aspires to follow the kind of Lincoln example, uniting the country after civil war. And yet here is a country that is deeply divided, as this election describes, and, of course, logjam on Capitol Hill. He's not yet Lincoln, is he?
No, I think there's going to be two big challenges for him. The first is that he does have to reach symbolically across the aisle. He has to do almost what LBJ did, which is to bring in as many of those Republicans and Democrats to the White House, lunch, dinner, breakfast, just begin to create those relationships. But if the obstructionism still lasts, then he has to go to the public, which he did last night, force them to force the Congress to do something by using the outside pressure to get Congress inside to have to finally act.
Well, now, you've been into the White House to see him on regular intervals. I'm just wondering whether you personally feel a bit disappointed by the first 4 years and whether you now think the second 4 years still have a chance of doing what Lincoln achieved.
Oh, I have no doubt that he has learned from those first 4 years. That's all you really ask of a president. I mean, think of it. If Lincoln had not won a second term, he'd be remembered as the president who didn't win the Civil War. If FDR hadn't won a second term, he had not ended the Depression. And the great thing about having the chance again after you've had it for 4 years is you can learn what didn't work well. So my guess is that having learned from those, and Lincoln was a man who learned from his errors, was able to grow in that job, was able to grow in that job, was able to grow in that job. And if that's what Obama can do, then that second term could be pretty special.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. So, it's over, Obama has won, and perhaps no one is happier than this little girl.
Tired of Barack Obama and Mitt Romney.
That's why you're crying? Oh, it'll be over soon, Abby. Okay? The election will be over soon, okay?
Okay.
All right, here we go.
My guest today is Tom Woods, historian, economist, political analyst, and author. The books with which I am most familiar, the 2004 New York Times bestseller, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, and a few years later, 33 Questions About American History That You're Not Supposed to Ask. Tom, what's the most recent one, Rollback, that you have out?
Yeah, that was 2011, Rollback, which is subtitle should be Why Everything Should Be Abolished.
So we did a history series on my show now a couple years ago. You would have been very helpful then. Unfortunately, at the time, we were a very small show. I didn't go after you then, but I'm certainly glad to have you now. And one of the first questions I always like to ask people is about background, their philosophical development, how you came to be where you are today, especially when, you know, somebody looks at your bio and they see Harvard was where your undergrad was, and then you got a PhD from Columbia, and they say, libertarianism, how on earth did that happen?
Yeah, well, I'm going to go backwards, because Columbia was an extremely, at least the first couple of years I was there, was actually the loneliest time of my whole life. I mean, I really felt completely isolated. Even though I'm not the sort of person, I sometimes hear people say, you're going to lose all your friends and family if you become a libertarian. I mean, well, gee, that sounds attractive. And I actually haven't had that happen, by and large. You know, I mean, most of my friends are sympathetic, but I'm able to get along with my neighbors just fine. You know, I'm a nice enough guy. But yet, in Columbia, that just was not enough. Like, you had to be on the team. And, I mean, Columbia was just in the history department, it was just left-wing, through and through. Harvard was more just establishment. You know, like, half the people teaching you are former federal government flunkies. So they're going to give you the establishment line. They weren't left-wing, per se. They were just establishment. Columbia was left-wing. Like, we had outright Stalinists on the faculty. So my dissertation was advised by Alan Brinkley, whose father was the newsman David Brinkley. And Brinkley is sort of an establishment Hillary Clinton-style liberal. And that made him the most right-wing member of the department, actually. I mean, in fact, there was a communist group on campus that complained that Brinkley was too right-wing because he was critical of Stalin. I mean, like, that was our campus.
That's extreme.
So I felt very, very isolated until I just started making friends outside the department and had no connection to history at Columbia, and then I was much happier. But, yeah, it was hard. It was very, very hard. Now, as an undergrad at Harvard, I went in there as kind of a middle-of-the-road Republican. Because that's middle-of-the-road in the sense that I basically favored lower spending, but I wasn't totally on board. I still felt like you needed all these various government programs, and I felt like you needed a muscular and aggressive military policy, foreign policy. So I was like the worst of all worlds when I entered college. It was just horrible. I more or less, though, I believed in the free market economy, I guess, and I was against communism. So that was the glimmer of hope that you found in me. And once I got there, I came from as New England towns go, a relatively conservative New England town, North Andover. And so when I got there to Cambridge, I was just so shocked at everything I saw. Like, one of the courses I took, required us to buy our books at a Maoist bookstore called Revolution Books.
Yes.
And this absolutely shocked me. I was blown away that I had, and I just resolutely refused to do this. I'll get the book some other way. And it was just constantly being exposed to nuttiness like this that, instead of making me into a left-wing nut, it made me dig in my heels further and say, no, I am not one of these people. And it made me kind of cling to my beliefs, but more systematically. I thought, well, if these people hold that view, then I want to hold the exact opposite view.
Right.
To be as normal as I can. And it was that combined with some seminars I went to. I went to a week-long seminar offered by the Institute for Humane Studies that really, really helped to sharpen my thinking and make me more consistent. And then I went in 1993 to the Mises Institute's Mises University week-long event, and that really was the capstone for me. I never really thought the same way after that. After being exposed to all that stuff and reading all the stuff in preparation for it, I just devoured it all. I felt like, yeah, this makes sense. Like, before, I was just some kind of wimpy, middle of the road, nothing, but now I got it. Like, this is it. Right. Absolutely. And also what helped was the feeling that I had been scammed by Rush Limbaugh and that sort of crowd. Like, when I really encountered what it really meant to be for the free market, I felt like these people are such imposters. I have to prevent other people from being taken in by them. So that was sort of my story. And then combine that with my increasing unease with the foreign policy. Like, even though I was as flag waving and gung ho as you could ask for,
right,
I just had real difficulty explaining away the level of casualties suffered by the Iraqis in the first Iraq war in 1991. It was just so lopsided and so horrific. And then at the same time, in the U.S., we were being taught to celebrate this and have parades. And I just thought this was totally inhuman that you could act this way. And no matter how you felt about that country, those people never did anything to you. And now a lot of these kids have no fathers anymore. And you want me to have a parade for that? Like, what the heck's going on? So ultimately, all these things sort of came together. And before you know it, you know, here I am.
Yeah, I got all excited when you mentioned revolution books. It's nothing to get excited about, everybody, but I was working for an educational consulting company in the Boston area. So it is still there, as far as it was there in 2006. And I think I was on the BU campus, which is right on Mass Ave, where I think that bookstore is in Cambridge. And, you know, Mass Ave just goes on forever. And one day I wound up there, and it was at a pretty crucial period in my development. You know, I was becoming a libertarian. I'm pretty sure that I had been listening that day to like Free Talk Live or something on my iPod. And I walked into this place, and it was shocking that this was a real, and, you know, it wasn't as overt the communism, but you know, you do see the Red Star, and there are a lot of, you know, bearded men with corduroy sport coats with leather elbow patches walking around like they're involved in something really important, when in all actuality they're just cashiers in a bookstore. But that was a shocking experience to wander in there one day. But while we're on the subject of the folks at Revolution Bookstore, there seems to be a theme. This is kind of a history warm-up that I wanted to do with you before we talk about Liberty Classroom. There's a lot of people today in the mainstream media who clearly haven't learned from history, who are telling us about the importance of learning from history. And here's what I mean. We had the inauguration last week. I remember 4 years ago, there was this real theme of FDR and the Great Depression, Paul Krugman calling for the new deal. Everyone talking about Obama as the new FDR. Time magazine ran a cover where they had actually photoshopped Obama to look like FDR. And at that time, or right up into the present day, I was kind of wondering if you had any strategies or you had any experience trying to calm down somebody's excitement, knowing what you know about the Great Depression, when they say, yes, here comes Obama to save us, or here, not just Obama the man, but here comes these ideas, here comes these Keynesian ideas to save us from this economic downturn. Do you have a like an elevator speech that you can give to somebody who's really, really charged up about that kind of stuff to set them straight?
You mean focusing specifically on what history can tell us, like from the FDR years?
Yes.
Well, I would say this. There are people who try to claim that, after all, Roosevelt's New Deal got us out of the Great Depression. There are some historians who are honest enough to admit that he didn't get us out of the Depression, but that with those programs, but that World War II did. That's a separate question. And I have a whole page of resources explaining, including a video that I did at libertyclassroom.com/war that deals with the World War II thing. But on the New Deal in particular, the historians who claim that it did have good effects, that economic growth did pick up, and sure, unemployment was in the double digits, but it was better than it was when he took office years and years earlier. The basic answer to this is, well, the United States has recovered from every economic downturn it ever had, right? There was always a recovery that came after. So it's not enough to say, well, there was a recovery, therefore FDR caused it. Then how do you account for all the other recoveries when the federal government did not intervene at all? Like, there was no intervention after the Panic of 1837. There was no intervention after the Panic of 1857. The federal government didn't do anything after the Panic of 1873. Like, how did they get out of those things? There was no FDR around then. So it's not enough to say things got better. They always get better. The point is, they got better much, much more slowly and sluggishly in the 1930s than at any time ever before. And that happens to be the one time that the federal government was constantly intervening, with prices, with wages, with productions, with work hours, with production rules, with cartels, with agriculture, with whatever, with the money supply, whatever it is, taxes, all over the place. Now, that could just be a coincidence, but I somehow don't think that the other side of this argument would allow us to make the argument if the case were reversed. Suppose it were the case that in all the previous recessions in U.S. history, there had been a Franklin Roosevelt and a New Deal, and we got out of those quickly. And then the first time we really languished in depression, that was because we had a terrible free market guy who just wouldn't intervene. Do you think they would allow us to claim, look, that's just a coincidence? The one time we didn't intervene, it just happened to go on forever. They would say, no, that's because of your stupid free market and because you didn't intervene. How come they don't allow us to reverse the argument when, in fact, the reality is the opposite? The reality is the recovery occurs usually pretty swiftly in all these other cases with no government involvement. The one time it's drawn out is when the government gets involved. Maybe that's not a coincidence. And then I go in and to give some of the specific arguments to justify this conclusion in the books you mentioned, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History and 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. These are at my website, tomwoods.com.
You know, right up to the modern day, we did have this inauguration last week. And last March, I think Tim Burton, bear with me here for a second, Tim Burton released a movie called Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer. Then some months go by, and Steven Spielberg puts out an even more far-fetched movie. I say that because it's based on the work of Doris Kearns Goodwin about the presidency of Lincoln during the Civil War. Then we hear this talk about a civil war in the United States over the gun issue. Then Lincoln is going to get sworn in, Obama is going to get sworn in on Lincoln's Bible. And then he is sworn in. People start comparing his second inaugural address to Lincoln's second inaugural address. And I start to say, man, things are getting pretty Lincoln-y around here. And that kind of scares me. The same way I was a little bit apprehensive about all the tie-ins that Hollywood and the mainstream media did with Obama and Roosevelt during his first term. So just speak to the Lincoln thing for a minute, because one of the things that scares me about that is both parties want to claim Lincoln as their own. And it seems to be that the lesson with Lincoln is that there's no abuse or overreach of presidential power that could not be justified for some kind of greater good. And I know I've heard you talk about maybe more of the blame for getting away from, you know, the constraints of executive power lies with Teddy Roosevelt. But Lincoln is a part of that, too.
Yeah.
And people want to claim Lincoln as their own, I think, for that reason.
Yeah. Well, my emphasis on Teddy Roosevelt is because he did it during peacetime when it was much harder for presidents to get away with that sort of thing. You know, in wartime conditions, there's always some excuse why the president has to have such and such power. Now, on Lincoln, I mean, I personally think Tom DiLorenzo has done excellent work and on this subject with his books. And he's not digging up stuff that people don't know, that historians don't know. He's digging up stuff that the general public doesn't know. And it tells rather a different story from the comic book version that we get. And
yeah.
Now, of course, we're all taught that, well, we needed Lincoln to free the slaves. The point is, Lincoln wasn't – I take him at his word that he was opposed to slavery. Even though he was not viewed as an abolitionist, Frederick Douglass did not think of him as an abolitionist. He referred to him as the white man's president. He liked Lincoln, but he was honest about who the man really was. We know now, because of recent research by a guy named Philip Magnus of an American university, that it wasn't that he did not abandon the idea of colonizing the freed slaves in the middle of the war, which a lot of historians had claimed, all the way up to the very bitter end. He was desperately looking for some place he could send these people because they absolutely could not be integrated into American society. No school kid is learning about any of that. Lincoln made perfectly clear that he would have been absolutely at peace if the southern states had continued to have slavery and if a constitutional amendment had been passed that would forever prohibit the abolition of slavery at any time in the future. Lincoln said this, that he had absolutely no objection to that. He believed that was already constitutional law, so codifying it further caused him no difficulty. Lincoln believed in the nationalist rather than the compact theory of the Union. The nationalist theory is false, and yet we are we are living with the consequences of it today, because now every time the federal government wants to oppress us or oppress the states, it points to Lincoln for its inspiration. And we live in a system now where the states believe they have no ability to resist the federal government. They have to just lie down and take it. This was not the American tradition. This was the French Revolutionary tradition, but presumably the United States is supposed to be different from other countries.
Right.
So political centralization and crony capitalism and also violations of the laws of war and jailing the legislature of Maryland to make sure they couldn't vote to secede. And I mean, one just goes on and on and on. And there's always some excuse that, yeah, there was a greater good. That greater good didn't even occur to Lincoln until a year and a half into the war. And even then, he did it entirely as a war measure. And you say, yeah, well, who cares? At least we got it. That is true. I mean, that is a very, very important silver lining of this. But let's also remember that every other country in the Western Hemisphere that ended slavery did it without bloodshed in the 19th century. Every single one managed to do it. So unless you're going to claim the United States was uniquely savage, presumably there must have been some other way to do this. But finally, I would just say that Lincoln is an instrument in bringing about and helping to give greater impetus to centralized governments around the world. And what did that give us? Yes, it's true that a large, powerful centralized government can indeed do away with oppressions at the local level. It can get rid of slavery with just a snap of its fingers. But at the same time, it can also conscript you into the military. It can engage in genocide. I mean, if we look at just World War I alone, the number of people who died in World War I was greater than the number of slaves there were in the entire South. And that was what was made possible by these centralized governments. So yes, they can do some good. That's true. At least that, you know, there's some silver lining to them. But the record of the 20th century in general is not very favorable to them.
Yeah, and I think that one of the reasons why I brought these two examples of these two periods of time and these two presidents, Roosevelt in the Great Depression and Lincoln in the Civil War, is, yeah, these are names that are coming up again today to justify the expansion of executive power and the loss of freedom. As if we, you know, this is our heritage and we should be proud that we have leaders today that we can compare to these great men of the past. And the thing with Lincoln, too, is the states' rights issue. And now states' rights might not mean much to you and me, but maybe it's just one of those accidents of history that was useful to some historians later, but states' rights was tied to the idea of slavery. States' rights was tied to the idea of the Confederacy permanently with that event. So that is a real turning point, even though it was accelerated and exacerbated with, you know, both Roosevelts, Johnson, Wilson, Bush, Obama, bringing us right up to the present day. But this discussion, I think, Tom, moves us right into what I really wanted to discuss with you on the show today, even if just briefly, the Liberty Classroom, where people have an opportunity to undo some of this bad government school, I was going to call it education, but schooling, you know, in history and economics topics.
Sure. I mean, I think we know, and certainly people who listen to your podcast know, the purpose of schooling as we see it as funded by the government is not to encourage independent thinking or to dissent from the consensus, whether moral or historical, of the society. That's not the point. The point is to indoctrinate you in certain pieties and to prepare you to repeat those things and to bend the knee appropriately and wave incense at the right images and so on. And a lot of people went through that through no fault of their own. And now they feel like, well, what am I going to do? Right? I mean, I want to have real knowledge. I want to know U.S. history, or I want to know European history, or I want to know economics, or I want to know why is Keynes wrong, or, you know, things of that sort. So I started libertyclassroom.com with the idea of just offering course after course that you can listen to in your car. Every lecture of them is available in video if you want to watch it, or audio if you want to just listen in your car. You don't have to be online at any particular time. They're already recorded, just waiting for you. So we have six courses right now. In the next month, we'll have a seventh. And by the summertime, I expect an eighth and maybe even a ninth. So we're just going to keep on adding them. And so once you join, you just get everything. If I add a new one, just get that too. And the idea of it is that you're going to be learning from me and from people I trust, who have good records and who are friends of mine, who aren't going to bamboozle you, but going to give you the real stuff. And for every single topic, we have recommended readings, so you don't have to engage in a crapshoot to figure out what's reliable and what isn't. We have discussion forums if you want something clarified or ask us a question. We have a live session once a month where we take your questions in real time. And I think it's the most important thing I've done. I'm really, really happy with it. I have got course ideas for the future. Like the next course I want to do after we do the one on the Constitution is we're going to do a course on Keynesianism, because a lot of our people kind of know Keynes is wrong, but maybe we have kind of a cartoonish version of Keynes. So what our course will do is give you half the course will be without any bias, just laying out this is what the Keynesian system is, and these are the claims that it makes. And then the second half of the course will be systematically dismantling those claims. Now, I mean, if our people had that type of knowledge at their fingertips, this would be, I mean, we would just be unstoppable. I mean, no one would want to debate us at that point. I mean, they don't want to debate us now because they feel like we don't matter enough for them to bother. But in the future, it'll be they don't dare try. So that's what we're up to over there.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's occurred to me in the past is when we look at the sort of mainstream political discussion between the two parties, everybody kind of knows that it doesn't make any sense, I think, including the people who are in that discussion. And when liberty-minded people try to intervene in what's so clearly wrong, and it's evidenced the inaccuracy and the nonsensicalness of some of their arguments by the number of logical fallacies that it takes for them to even just get through a few sentences on whatever they're supporting. But I think it's an issue, and maybe it's more common than a lot of people want to admit, is that people don't have the ammunition of background knowledge necessary to go into those debates, because the odds are already stacked against you. You know, you're, well, it's all very emotional. I'm sure you've experienced this from talking to people. So you're putting people into this emotional place where they have to admit that they're wrong, that maybe they've been deceived. So you're already kind of starting from less than zero, and you really, really need to have a solid background knowledge if you want to engage in those debates, if these people will even debate you. A mutual friend of ours, Bob Murphy, has been trying to debate one of these guys for years.
Yeah.
What you said about a government school and this being a counter to government school, I thought a nice note to end on today would be, you know, I've heard you talk in your discussions about history, about entrepreneurship, the history of entrepreneurship. It's a wonderful and very inspiring history from all over the world of entrepreneurs and inventors. And it's kind of, you know, forced out of the government school narrative because all of the stories need to be devoted to, you know, how the government is a savior, how if it wasn't for Roosevelt or the progressive era, you know, we'd all be living in this world controlled by these, you know, monopoly men lighting cigars with $100 bills, and we'd be on whatever the purple properties are on the huddled together on the monopoly board.
Mediterranean. So,
yeah, the Mediterranean. Yes, yes. So I wondered if you had one good anecdote about one of these entrepreneurs, because we really get nothing. We get these names like Rockefeller and Carnegie. And then the really sad part is we learn that they're bad because they were rich. Like one time there was a guy named Carnegie with no money. One time there was a guy named Rockefeller, even Rothschild, who had no money and worked their way up from that. And they're demonized for their wealth. The whatever the innovation is ignored. And really what's important, like the reasons why there is, you know, a lot of bad stuff associated with these names is these powerful foundations, like, you know, use the world as our own fantasy football league kind of
right.
thinking.
Yeah.
That the Rockefeller Education Board. We learn nothing about that, but entrepreneurship is just kind of glossed over in the entire presentation of American history. So
yeah. On that, of course, we have to be able to distinguish conceptually between the men and what they did from an economic point of view and the foundations that they established, which have been terrible. Okay, so
yeah.
I don't endorse any of that. And so I just want to look at what contributions did they make to improving people's standard of living. But you're right. Those are the names we hear about an awful lot. I recommend there's a fantastic book. It's huge. It's like a picture book but with a lot of information in it. And it's called They Made America. And it's just I don't remember how many dozens of vignettes of great inventors and entrepreneurs in U.S. history are in there. But how interesting, and a great many of them, as you say, start from nothing. And it's an astonishing thing to learn exactly how they go about doing what they did. Now, of course, that's a gutsy title, They Made America, because we're all taught that, you know, the working class through sheer brawn, they made America, or the slaves made America, and we're all the beneficiaries of that. Well, everybody has a hand in making America, that's true. But on the other hand, if my father, who was a forklift operator all his life, if he hadn't had a forklift, he wouldn't have been able to make a whole lot. It was because somebody had the entrepreneur, well, first of all, the genius to invent something like this, and then somebody built it and marketed it and put it out there that helped my father to be 20 times as productive as he would have been before. So if people have been engaged in producing all the things that constitute America just with their bare hands, we wouldn't have very much. So it's not that the working class made America. The working class plus the greatest machinery in the history of the world made America. Well, who made those machines? Very interesting question. It's answered in They Made America. But also, just to give one specific example, as you asked for, in my book, 33 Questions About American History, I think it's actually the 33rd question, if I remember correctly. It's, who was S.B. Fuller? S.B. Fuller was a businessman, mid-20th century, who, he was black, and he basically developed a cosmetics company, and he was hoping, he didn't just hire blacks, but he wanted to show that he was not convinced that politics was the way forward for blacks, and it really hadn't been the way forward for the Irish, for example. The Irish came to the U.S., and unlike other groups that went into entrepreneurship or small business or whatever, the Irish overwhelmingly put their eggs in the politics basket. And so they did build up some formidable political machines in various cities. But the average Irish American had very little to show for this, in the same way that in Detroit, for example, in the latter part of the 20th century, Detroit had everything you could want from a point of view of black politics. They had a black mayor, city council, everything you could think of. Everybody was black. And yet the average black person had almost nothing. So he was convinced that, no, this obviously there's got to be something more to this. We have to prove ourselves. And so we have to do that by producing things people want. And he said, instead of crying to me that people aren't nice to us, he said, it's true. And that's unjust. And we shouldn't put up with it. But at the same time, we got to realize we are strong because we are a market. Look at how many of us there are. If we bought from each other, look at what a market we are for each other. And so there are so many testimonies by black entrepreneurs saying that I got my start because I worked for S.B. Fuller. And now, and I've got a, or at least in the bio of S.B. Fuller, there's a great photo of him giving, he used to give away a Cadillac every year to one of his best salesmen. And everybody's just beaming and had pictures of his labor force. And it's so interesting because when Fuller turned 70, here he is basically espousing the exact opposite of the Jesse Jackson political action approach to black improvement. And yet who was at the 70th birthday party for S.B. Fuller if not Jesse Jackson, who basically had to admit, you know, you can't argue with success.
Reminds me of just another one of those, you know, government school stories about how I think a lot of people learn this message of disempowerment, and I've described the government school process as this simultaneous construction process, which is the myth of the state and how great it is and how it can save us all, and this demolition process, which is the demolition of the power of the individual. So we learn about civil rights as something that basically, you know, three people are responsible for: Martin Luther King, who gave some speeches, Rosa Parks, who sat in the wrong place on a bus, and Lyndon Johnson, who signed a piece of paper. And that's terribly tragic because, you know, as you also spoke to in your example, there are so many more people behind the scenes. There's so many more people responsible and participating in that. And they had so much more power than is recognized in these books. So I think that that's an important lesson. But I know you're short on time. I want to thank you so much. Like I said, you should have been here 150 episodes ago, but I'm glad we finally got a chance to talk. And I'm planning to see you at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum coming up in February. Is there anything else you want to mention or plug before I let you go?
No, I'm glad to have had the chance to chat. I'm looking forward to the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, which I hope everybody will attend. And yeah, just check out libertyclassroom.com. And then also, I have a lot of people who like to watch my videos or follow me on Facebook and don't know that I blog. But I blog like anywhere from 3 to 10 times a day, depending on how I feel. So check out tomwoods.com or put it in your RSS reader, because you might find something of use on it.
It's been a real pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much for coming on School Sucks, and hopefully we can do this sometime in the future.
Thanks, Brett.
Now there's our city regiments. Just see what they have done. The first to offer to the state to go to Washington to protect the federal capital and the flag they love so dear. And they've done their duty nobly like good New York volunteers. 'Tis my great delight to march and fight like a New York volunteer.